This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Literally on vacation with a friend in New Orleans, and we were talking shit at a bar the last night, and I was telling him about like my rebranding crisis, and he's like, I know you've already thought of this, but what about her first 100K? And I was like, no, I have not. And I bought the domain that day, and then everything changed from then on.
Welcome to Creative Elements, a show where we talk to your favorite creators and learn what it takes to make a living from your art and creativity. I'm your host, Jay Klaus. Let's start the show. Hello, welcome back to another episode of Creative Elements. Pop quiz, do you know what today, Tuesday, January 18th, 2022 is? It's the 2021 fourth quarter estimated tax deadline for business owners, of course. I know, finance, accounting, it's not exactly the most exciting subject in the world for most creatives. But what if that is just a story that we've been sold our whole lives? What if we have been systematically trained to think the subjects of money and finance are taboo, or too boring, or too complicated for us to worry about? Up until just a couple of years ago, I was pretty firmly in the money is boring, money is hard, I don't want to even look at my bank account camp. But then I decided that I didn't want to be average at my finances. I wanted to at least be above average and take control of my money. And that has led to some great results. I see money as a tool now. Not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, just a thing. Something that I can leverage to achieve the things that I want to achieve, and to leverage it, I need to have it. And to have it, I need to earn it, or at least do a better job of managing it. Lo and behold, since paying more attention to my finances, they've gotten much, much better. I have automated saving systems, I pay my quarterly taxes on time, I still get a tax refund despite being responsible for my own tax withholdings, and I can even invest. I have a great retirement portfolio, a small startup portfolio, a crypto portfolio, and a home with my fiance. That didn't come from some sudden windfall of cash. Up until just about a year or two ago, I was still pretty broke. It came from simply deciding that I was going to take control of my money and my financial education. That's a choice that anyone can make. You can make it right now, and today's guest can help.
Welcome to the Financial Feminist Podcast, your new favorite source for inspiring interviews with badass world-changing women about how money affects us differently, and of course, the financial advice you need to get your first 100K. I'm your host, Tori Dunlap, an entrepreneur, speaker, educator, and founder of Her First 100K, a community of women fighting the patriarchy by getting rich.
That was today's guest, Tori Dunlap, on her Financial Feminist Podcast. That podcast has spent time ranked as the number one business podcast on both Apple and Spotify. And it's not even what Tori is truly known for. Tori is known as the creator of Her First 100K, a growing media empire built to fight financial inequality by giving women actionable resources to better their money. She has helped over 800,000 women negotiate salary, pay off debt, build savings, and invest. And Tori herself saved her first 100K by the time she was just 25 years old. And she gives some of that credit to the way that her parents raised her to think about money.
I was lucky enough to have parents who are really focused on providing a financial education for me. And I grew up thinking that that was the norm. I grew up thinking, okay, everybody knows not to overspend on credit cards and everybody knows how to save money. And of course, you know, graduated high school, got into college and started having conversations with friends and realized that that was a privilege.
So Tori took that education to college with her and imagined that she would apply it to her budding corporate career, climbing the corporate ladder and saving along the way.
I graduated college in 2016 with dual degrees in organizational communication, which is like marketing with less math, and a theater. Didn't study finance, didn't study even business technically, and went and dove into the corporate world and was working in marketing. And then 5 months later, Trump got elected. It became very clear to me that I was coming into womanhood and coming into adulthood in a very different America than I think a lot of us expected. And that with that financial education came like the best form of protest. And so I started the blog that later became Her First 100K in late 2016.
That blog was focused on financial education. After a few years and a lot of work and a pivotal rebrand that we talk about in the interview, Tori's content on social media began striking a chord. In October of 2019, she had 8,000 followers when she was featured on Good Morning America. That publicity turned the flywheel even faster for Tori, but she was starting to see growth on Instagram plateau. So in 2020, she decided to give TikTok a try.
I had 30,000 followers at the time we blew up on TikTok, and that was in July of 2020. I literally started producing financial content like midway through July, had my first viral video, which had like 4 million, I think it has 4 million views now, go viral, I think a week after I started posting content, and it blew everything up.
Today, Tori has more than 2 million followers on TikTok. She has more than 590,000 followers on Instagram, and at the age of just 27 years old, she had earned and saved enough money to retire. So in this episode, we talk about Tori's start as a creator, what she's learned about what works on TikTok, her best advice for getting featured in major publications, and why service is at the core of Tori's winning content strategy. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen. You can find me on Twitter at jklaus or on Instagram at creativeelements.fm. Tag me, say hello, and let me know that you're listening. And now let's talk to Tori.
And I started my first business when I was 9. So I owned vending machines, the kind where you put a quarter in and you get a handful of candy out, like gumball machines. And I had 15 of those by the time I graduated high school. All the profits went to my college fund. And then one of the other things my dad and I did when I was in high school is we'd sneak on to golf, because this is so bad, but we'd sneak on to golf courses at like 9:30 at night when in the summer when, you know, there was still light outside, but no one was on the course. And we would get into the pond, pull golf balls out, go home and spend like hours in front of the TV out in the garage cleaning them. And then we'd sell them on Craigslist. And, you know, some of these like Titleist Pro V1 balls, you know, go for, you know, like a sleeve of three is pretty expensive. And so we obviously discounted them. But yeah, that was like probably the craziest way I've made money. And it was just my dad and I just being like, you know how many balls are in this lake? You know how many balls are in this pond? Like, let's just pull them out and sell them. So yeah, it was crazy.
I was going to ask where the idea came from, if you remembered.
It was probably my dad. My dad is very, very, very golf obsessed. It's like my mom and I are dog and golf in terms of priorities in his life. And so, yeah, I think we're the kind of family that goes somewhere and is like, oh, how much revenue are they bringing in per day, right? Or how much does it cost to maintain this place? And so we were probably out, you know, golfing and we're like, how many balls? Like, what is the value of this lake when you hit all the balls into the, you know, the pond or the lake? So yeah, I think we did it probably 6 times over the course of a couple summers. And yeah, it was really funny. It just became like more about the story than of course about the amount of money. Yeah.
I love that though. There's another guy I had on the podcast really early on. His name is Matt Giovannisi. And he said he was the same way. He was like, I'm the type of guy that drives around a neighborhood and I just look at houses and say like, wonder what that guy does. And
sure.
I'm in a similar place, but it's so weird how taboo it is to talk about that sometimes. Like, money rules our lives in a lot of ways.
Right.
And it's something that we're afraid to ask, like, how did you buy this? How did you afford this? How did you get this?
Well, and I have a theory about that. I think I fully believe that it is a patriarchal narrative, right? That maintains the status quo, right? It's patriarchal, it's racist, it's ableist, right? The people already in power who already have money are telling you don't talk about money to keep you underpaid and overworked, right? And financially unstable. That's the whole thing. So when you hear, oh, don't talk about money, that's taboo, or like it's really inappropriate to talk about your salary, or, you know, having debt is shameful, right? These are all narratives. Or women aren't supposed to be investors, right? These are all narratives that we're told in order for us to not become financially educated, because they profit off of our silence or they profit off our inaction. You better believe that people who have money are talking about money. That's part of the reason they have it, right? So I think that that's one huge narrative, the societal norm that talking about money is impolite, that I'm really trying to buck, because I think it's just, yeah, it's not helpful to anybody except the people who already have money and power.
Totally. I mean, how else can you explain not having personal finance classes in like K through 12, really? Like, that was never anything we had available.
Right. Or hearing from your corporations, like, we bar talking about your salary with your coworkers. They can't legally do that. That's actually, you're legally allowed to talk about your salary with your coworkers. That is purely a power move in order to make sure that you're not figuring out that Chad, who has less experience than you, is actually getting paid 25% more, right? So yeah, I think it's really important when it comes to money to like zoom out and be like, what narratives were we taught, either by society, by our family, by our communities? And, you know, how is that impacting the way we as adults now view money? And I have an episode on my podcast. It's the second episode where we do like a really big deep dive into like the psychological bullshit around money, because the way we view money has everything to do with your childhood and the way you were brought up. And I think that that can have the most lasting impacts on you, whether that's your personal finance or, you know, if you're a business owner or your business's finances.
When I started researching the link between how our parents managed money, how we viewed money growing up, our childhood bullshit around money, is I realized they're pretty much inextricably linked. The majority of money habits are actually cemented by age 7. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. The majority of our money habits are cemented by second grade, meaning the way we manage money as an adult, the way we view money in our society, the relationship we have to money has largely been formed and, you know, established since we were kids. So one of the practices that I like to do with clients is journal through that first money memory. And if you're on a run, if you are in your car, I would encourage you to either contemplate these questions or save this episode for when you can sit down and actually journal.
So yeah, I think you can draw a through line through all of that.
Because this is like systemically taboo and kind of like dampened in us, have you experienced people being really curious and wanting to talk to you about this? Or have you had to kind of break people into it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think once you, like, even me talking about like it's a narrative perpetuated by like the system or the patriarchy or whatever you want to call it, that blows people's minds. And they're like, oh, of course, right? But we've never had it framed that way, because it's just been, you don't talk about money, right? And so I think that once people get that, they're 100% on board. We're also very voyeuristic when it comes to money, right? You look at a lot of the money media out there. Perfect example, like the Refinery 29 money diaries that are super popular, where someone will literally journal anonymously about everything they spend money on for a week. Like, people are obsessed with those, right? Or like Graham Stephan will break down, like, you know, what somebody spent on a $80,000 salary, right? So I think we are, and you know, you even look at like money media, like the, you know, the Real Housewives, right? We're obsessed with those shows, or like Million Dollar Listing. We really are obsessed with wealth in America, but yet no one's talking about it. So it's like this weird contradiction where we, you know, are obsessed with rich people and luxury and Elon Musk's stock, you know, ownership and shit like that, right? But like, at the same time, there's so many barriers, both systemic and personal, for us personally as an individual to, you know, feel financially confident, not even rich or wealthy, right? But just like feeling like you're not living paycheck to paycheck. So I feel like there is so much interest for people in talking about money, especially when you frame it in terms of like, this is a form of protest. Because if you are, you know, from any sort of marginalized group, you're a woman, you're a person of color, you're a member of the LGBTQ community, you're disabled, right? You having money is an act of protest against the very system that is structured for you to not have money. So I think when you frame it like that, people are like, yeah, let's talk about it.
I love that. So when did you decide or realize that you wanted to make this kind of your personal mission of sharing this idea and helping women and marginalized people to really take this stand?
I think it honestly was when Trump got elected. You know, it was my own, probably, you know, it was my own privilege of growing up, you know, in, you know, a middle class white household, right? Even as a woman, of course, you know, every single person has privilege in some way, right? And for me, that was, you know, I never wanted for anything. I had parents who worked really hard to provide a really good life for me. And I think, you know, I graduated college and was like, cool, first woman president, let's go. Literally, like, graduated, got my first job in May of 2016 and thought, we will have our first woman president 4 months later. And of course, that did not happen. And so I think for me, that was like, I hate even to say a shock, but it was, you know, and that I think calls out my own privilege that it was shocking that Trump got elected. But I think, yeah, I was just really surprised that that was the kind of America that I lived in and that we all lived in. And I think just realizing that, you know, feeling this like draw to like activism and to, you know, going to women's marches and having really hard conversations with people. And again, coming into adulthood and realizing like, what do I believe? What do I stand for? You know, and both also getting into corporate and realizing that this was not what I wanted at all. So, you know, I thought in college, okay, I'll become, you know, I'll get into marketing and I want to be VP of marketing by 30. Like that was the plan, is I'm going to have like my pencil skirt and my little, like, you know, my tote bag or something. I don't know. And I'm going to like have a Starbucks and like very Sex in the City, like walk through this, you know, the streets of a city and like conquer it. Right. That was like my vision for my life. And then got into it and was like, No, I don't respect who I work for. I don't like making somebody I don't respect rich. I don't like being told how much time I can take off. I don't like, you know, I don't like, even if my work is done, having to sit here and bullshit. Like, I didn't like any of that. And also watching, I've worked, you know, I had a pretty good job out of college, the first job, but it was also very, very male dominated. It was a bunch of like ex-military and ex-cops who, it was just very not the environment that I wanted. And I watched female coworkers get paid less. I watched, you know, other women and members of my team get discriminated against. I was sexualized. I had, you know, sexual comments said to me. And so it was just, it was a combination of all of these factors at the same time, which is like, not only is my personal experience, you know, in a very misogynistic environment where I'm realizing that in order to leave, I have to have the money to do so. Right. Or I have to get a better paying job in order to do so. But also having conversations with friends, seeing what's going on politically and socially in the States and across the world, it was, again, very clear to me that, OK, our best form of protest, our best form of rising up in a society is a financial education.
And I've heard you talk before about that financial education giving you choice as something that can really empower you. And in my own privilege, which I've been reckoning with and learning a lot about over the last couple of years, I realized that like, that's one of the greatest gifts I've been given. It's just like all along the way, I've had so much choice and opportunity. So can you talk a little bit about choice in your mind and what that gives to people?
Yeah. I mean, the example I like to give, or the examples, is when you give, you know, and as my work is largely with women. So when you give a woman money, right, her entire life opens up. She can leave the toxic situation, whether that's a job or a relationship that she doesn't want to be in anymore, because she has the money to do so, right? 99% of domestic violence cases have some sort of financial abuse tied to them. So you think about that. Of course, money changes everything, right? You can leave a violent, toxic, abusive situation because someone isn't controlling your money, right? So there's that example. You can donate to causes you believe in, right? I can literally go to my favorite charity right now and donate a bunch of money without even thinking about it. That's so fucking cool, right? I can, again, get married if I want to, not because I financially need a partner, but because I love this person, right? I can also not get married because I don't financially need somebody, right? I can have children or not have children. I can retire early. I can start my own business, right? There, all these options open up to you. So yeah, for me, like, financial stability means choices. And it's also so much bigger than you, because my financial freedom now, the ability for me as an individual to have choices. Now I'm showing literally millions of women across the entire world, this is what financial freedom can look like. It's taking myself to a 5-star hotel in Tuscany after I've had like the hardest year of my life, right? It is employing women in my business now. It is, you know, again, donating to causes I believe in, or buying the thing, buying the dinner, paying for my friend's dinner, right? I think that that's the power of it, is it just opens up so many options and choices that somebody may have not had before.
After a quick break, Tori and I explore her path from leaving corporate America to becoming a full-time creator and the rebrand that changed everything. And later, we dig into the role TikTok, Instagram, and publicity has played in her success. So stick around, and we'll be right back. If you know me, you know how much I believe in memberships. My membership is the core of my business, and earning an income directly from your audience is one of the most sustainable ways for you to become a professional creator too. So I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Uscreen. Uscreen is a beautiful all-in-one platform that helps content creators earn a living from their videos by unlocking predictable, recurring revenue. You can host private live streams for your members, build an on-demand catalog of premium content, and Uscreen gives you a community hub to interact with your members too. They can access your community from their mobile phone, so your membership is right there in their pocket. With a Uscreen account, you get video hosting, an out-of-the-box website, full payment and subscription management, and plenty of third-party integrations too. And Uscreen makes it easy to get set up. You get access to powerful website themes that are fully brandable with no coding skills required. Uscreen will even provide a dedicated success manager for you. Just about anyone that wants to make money from their content can do it with Uscreen. It's perfect for coaches, authors, influencers, and entrepreneurs in just about any niche. Right now, Uscreen is used by creators in fitness, education, news, kids entertainment, and more. That includes Yoga with Adrian and Creator Now, just to name a couple. Uscreen is the platform for building a video membership site that is great for generating a sustainable income for professional creators. If you create video content for your audience, I highly recommend checking it out. If you're interested in learning more about Uscreen, visit uscreen.link/J. That's uscreen.link/J, and let them know that I sent you. If you work with clients and you want to grow your top line revenue without growing a big payroll at the same time, then consider attending the Solopreneur Summit, a VIP event hosted by my friend Ken Yarmish. Ken has personally closed over $50 million in his career as a solopreneur, all in professional services. I've learned a lot from Ken, and he's worked with some of the biggest names today. People like Matt Barker, Nosheen Chen, Laura Acosta, and Jake Ward trust Ken to get clearer offers and scale their business with systems. Now, Ken is running a 2-day in-person summit on May 9th and 10th to help you build systems across marketing, sales, and client delivery. So now you too can grow without hiring. This will be a workshop setting. It's the anti-loud, obnoxious conference with no more than 50 people who will go deep with Ken and other experts that he's brought in to solve actual problems in your business. Ken and his invited experts will show you their proven systems across personal branding, driving inbound leads, social selling, crafting scalable offers, using AI to automate client delivery, and more. Stop guessing and start learning from those who are 3 to 5 steps ahead of you. Get actionable tactics and proven systems to accelerate your pipeline, close more deals, and get out of client delivery hell. Head to trs.club/summit to learn more and register for the Solopreneur Summit today. At that website, you'll see some of the other experts that are coming in that will allow you to go behind the scenes and look at their actual businesses. Again, that URL is trs.club/summit. One last time, that's trs.club/summit. Welcome back to my conversation with Tori Dunlap. Before the break, Tori was telling us about her experience graduating college, going into corporate America, and really not liking it. That was only a few years ago, but a far cry from where she is today as the creator of her first 100K. So I wanted to explore that pathway from corporate America to full-time creator a little bit deeper.
I knew I wanted to be my own boss someday. You know, I was, you know, again, my vending machine story, I didn't invent anything. It wasn't novel, but I loved that idea even when I was younger of, you know, running my own thing. And so I had been toying with the idea of starting a blog for literally years. And again, if you're listening and you're a person who's an aspiring entrepreneur, you're going to relate to this a lot. I was constantly going, oh yeah, I want to start a blog. But like, I don't have a website domain. I don't know what I'm going to call it. I don't know what my brand would be. I don't know what my colors would be. So I'm just not going to start. And I did that for years. And it's funny to think about where I would be even now. I'm super proud of where we are now. But if I would have started even years before then. So literally got just really honest with myself. And I'm like, what's holding you back? Okay, you don't have a website. Okay, pay the $25 and go get a website. Okay, you don't have a brand. You don't have to have that figured out yet. It's fine. You just need to get started. And this is what I tell entrepreneurs all the time is like, you are putting barriers up for yourself because you're scared of actually starting. And that's okay. But you're scared that maybe it's not going to be good enough, right? Or maybe you're going to fail. I would rather you try it and then fail than like knowing, N-O, knowing yourself of saying like, no, that's not going to work. No, I don't know what I'm doing. You will figure out what you're doing, right? So I just got honest with myself. There was one night in December 2016 where I was just like, okay, I'm going to buy a domain. And I slapped 3 blog posts up and I'm like, I launched it. No one knows, but I launched it. Right. And that blog later became Her First 100K. And it was a couple of years before I rebranded and was really clear that I just wanted to talk about money and that I wanted to talk about it as a form of protest. But I figured that out from running a blog for 2 years and figuring out what I didn't want to do or figuring out what did connect with people. It was literally, I've been wanting to do this for a really long time and I've been putting it off and making excuses for myself. What if I just started on this random Tuesday night? Cool. It's done now. It's launched. Now I can figure out what I want to do. So yeah, if you're out there going like, oh, I want to do this thing, but I don't have it all figured out. You're never going to have it all figured out. I'm a multi 7-figure business owner. I don't have it all figured out now. So you just kind of have to do it and you figure it out along the way.
In the beginning, as you're starting to knock down some of these dominoes of like, okay, I put the blog up. I put the blog post up.
Right.
What was your social contract with yourself after that? Was it, I'm going to publish weekly or monthly? Or, you know, a lot of people, even if they do get that point, now they feel like, now what? Now I'm stuck because
The consistency of it.
I'm not seeing attention or I'm not getting the response that I wanted. How did you approach the next steps?
I don't know if I so much made a schedule with myself as I was just like, I'm going to learn as much as possible from people I really admire. So, you know, I was looking at people whose type of businesses I wanted and consumed their content. And figured out, oh, why does that work for them? Oh, because they have a call to action in their Instagram post, right? Or, oh, they're opening up their DMs for people's questions. Oh, that's interesting, right? Or, you know, oh, they're creating that product. How did they figure out how to create that product? What's a course, right? Figuring out all of that. So I think for me, it was actually less about me producing content at that point, although I was, you know, I was coming out with a blog post, I was doing Instagram. It was like, who do I admire and what can I learn from them? And it wasn't just, again, like their podcast or their website. It was seeing actually what they did in their business. So especially early on, she's had kind of a reckoning during the Black Lives Matter movement. But Jenna Kutcher was a big, big like influence on my work, especially in the beginning where, you know, she had her podcast that I listened to, or I went to her website, but I'm like, why does this work for her? I just started looking at the content she posted on Instagram, right? Or just looked at, oh, she does this quiz on her website and that's how she gets emails, right? So just not only consuming the content that they're presenting for you to learn from, but actually learning from what they were doing, if that makes sense. Because I think those are two different things, right? Consume the content that's there that they're providing for you to learn, but also watch what they're doing in their businesses. And you can do this with me, right? You can come now and see, oh, she's doing that thing for this goal. And here's the outcome, right? That's I think really powerful. So I just watched for a really long time and I like was running my blog and obviously, you know, still at my 9-to-5 and figuring out, you know, what I wanted to do and what my voice was and what my niche was, but also really like, you know, being a sponge and absorbing as much of that as I could.
That's such a good meta point. This is something that I remember and then say, I'm going to do that. And then I forget this idea of like, anytime you take action on something,
yes,
pause and say like, why did I do that? What got me to do that? And it might not even be buying something. It might be like, why did I land on this website? What got me here?
Why did I give them my email? Why did I like that Instagram post? Why did I, you know, why did I even come on TikTok in the first place? Right. And I think that Yeah, that for me, that's so great that you said that, because that's my rule, like, for marketing. Because yeah, I worked as a marketer, is I always put myself in the other person's shoes of like, when I, as a consumer, yeah, consume content or buy something or click on something, what's going through my head? And I think that's hugely insightful when you're creating your own stuff, is putting your, you know, putting your mind where the other person is, or, you know, putting, what is the walk a mile in their shoes, right? Of just like figuring out like what is going to prompt them to take a certain action that you want. And again, what is the outcome of that action then?
So at this point, were you thinking, I'm going to be a blogger? Or were you thinking, I'm going to be like an influencer? Like, did you have a title or a model in mind for what, how this was going to work?
Yeah. So I was blogging and thought, I had a good friend who still runs a blog called Gen 20. And this is the classic thing of, again, learning from people. I literally found out she was in Seattle, was a huge admirer of hers, reached out and was like, hi, can I just take you for coffee? And she has been like such an amazing resource. And now we talk all the time of like, this brand reached out, they want to pay this, right? So like, we're like good friends now. So that's really cool, is like finding people that you can connect with and again, learning from them. So, you know, learning from her, I was like, oh, I think I want to be a blogger. But then you realize what you're being measured on as a blogger. And I found my content was really great. I knew my content was valuable, but blogging, especially if you want to get paid for it, is a lot of like, what are your page views? And at the time, my page views sucked. Like, it wasn't great. And so after about 2 years of really trying to like build up my blog and create a lot of content, I was just like, okay, I don't want to play the page view game. Like, I don't want to do that. And I was also starting to grow my Instagram, and I kind of plateaued. I was probably 2 years in at like 4,000 Instagram followers and maybe, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember my website views at that time. I don't know, 4,000, 5,000 a month maybe. And was just kind of like, okay, something's got to give. And I knew that I wanted to rebrand. I knew just from my own marketing prowess that Victory Media didn't tell you anything. I ran my business as Victory Media. That was my blog. I knew that Victory Media didn't tell you anything about who I was really or what I did, right? It was like a play on my name. And so I knew I wanted to rebrand. I knew that was important. But again, I got into the like, well, I don't know what to rebrand. I don't know what to call it. I don't want to niche myself down too hard. I knew I wanted to talk about money, but I didn't just want to be the debt person or the budget person or the investing person. And so I was at like a mastermind group, and it was my first time there. And for whatever reason, I felt called to tell these complete strangers about my own savings goal. And I had told, I think, my boyfriend at the time and like my parents and my best friend, and no one else knew, but I was trying to save $100,000 by 25. That was my goal, is like, if I can do this the day before I turn 26, it still counts. And it was completely arbitrary. It was just like, let's see if I can do it. I'm a big like numbers motivated person. And I ended up telling them about that goal. And one of the women there was like, well, that's your brand. That's your new brand. And I was like, what? And they're like, your first 100K. And I was like, oh, yep, that's it. And then I went through like a 3-month crisis where somebody owned the domain for your first 100K. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like, do I buy the domain? I don't have the money to do that. Do I do like you are first 100K, or do I like spell, you know, went through all that drama. And then I was literally on vacation with a friend in New Orleans, and we were talking shit at a bar the last night, and I was telling him about like my rebranding crisis, and he's like, I know you've already thought of this, but what about her first 100K? And I was like, no, I have not. And I bought the domain that day, and then everything changed from then on. When I rebranded and got really clear as to who my customer was, that's when everything changed, right? Her first 100K, right? Her appealing to women or women identifying people. First 100K, right? It's not your first million. It's not your 600K. It's your first 100K. Annex flexible. It can be whatever 100K you want. 100K debt paid off, 100K earned, 100K saved, right? So I think that was where everything transformed for me, was being really clear as to what I did. Okay, I talked about money. I talked about other things too, because money affects everything. Money affects your career. It affects your travel. It affects your lifestyle. But got really clear that I was the money person who talked to women who were just starting out. And that's when everything changed for me.
So cool. Did you have any trepidation around like, well, am I cutting out half my market? Because I know a lot of people, when they focus down, whether it's on gender versus anything else, it's just like, well, I'm cutting out half the people.
Yes. Thank you for asking this question. If you're listening, grab a notebook. I want you to write this in the biggest letters you possibly can. If you are trying to be everything to everybody, you are nothing to nobody. If you are trying to appeal to every single person, it will not work for you, because I did exactly that. I was like, okay, I'm just going to talk about personal finance and lifestyle. And I think for women, but if men want to come too, and like, I guess it's millennials, but really anybody can use this advice. It was so crazy because, again, put yourself in somebody's shoes. I'm going to come on somebody's website and go, wait, who is this person? What do they do? Is this for me? I don't know. I don't know who this person is. I get no concept as to what they're an expert in or what they can provide for me. And I don't even know if it's for me. Yes, if you are a Dave Ramsey follower and you're coming to me, my content is not for you. And you are going to be very vocal about that, Lord, aren't you? But I don't care. I don't care. Plenty of men consume my content, right? Or plenty of non-female identifying people consume my content and love it. But I am here largely for women, ages around, really my target demographic is like 25 to 34. Like that's my big demographic. And so, yeah, I think when you're trying to be everything to everybody, you're nothing to nobody. It ends up just really blurring your message, blurring who you are. And so what I recommend for new entrepreneurs is like, don't be afraid to be controversial. I'm not saying like say racist shit, that's not good. But like, if you have a statement that you know might piss some people off, but it's what you believe, that's okay, right? For me, it's like, I'm blatantly feminist. I'm here telling you that a personal finance, you know, education is your best form of protest. That's not for everybody. If you're conservative, if you are on, you know, if you are on the right, you're not going to love my content, right? It's called financial feminist. You're not going to love it, but that's okay because the people who do love it are totally bought in. They are total brand ambassadors for what we do at Her First 100K. They are so, so into it. They're ready to go, like tattoo it on their forehead. And that's what you want, right? Is you want to build an audience of people who know who you are, who get you, who identify with what you're trying to build, as opposed to somebody who's kind of like, I don't know. I don't know about this person. And so I'm not going to subscribe, or I'm not going to follow, or I'm not going to consume their content. So yeah, I think there is a hesitancy, especially when you're first getting started, that you're going to lose customers. And you might in the beginning, but I promise you it's more impactful to figure out exactly who you're talking to and talk to them.
This is a challenge I issue to myself pretty frequently also, and usually fail to deliver on, which is like polarization, being polarizing, having strong opinions isn't necessarily bad. And in this world, no. It can really help you grow quickly, it seems, because it is a very clear signal of this is who I am, this is what I'm about, right. This is what I believe, this is how I can help.
Well, and I would argue in 2021, it's almost expected from brands and influence. I mean, we look at, again, the Black Lives Matter resurgence of last year. If you weren't posting about it, that was a huge red flag to a lot of people. Like if you had any sort of platform and didn't acknowledge what was happening and didn't commit yourself to being better, that was a huge red flag, right? That was a big reckoning, whether that was big brands like, you know, Nike or Amazon to just small creators. So I think, honestly, it's not just a smart business move at this point. I think it is expected by consumers. I think they want more from you than just the content you produce. They want to know either who you are or what you stand for.
At the risk of going too in the weeds here, what about cursing? Like you are not afraid to say fuck. You no, don't mind that at all. Was that
my parents hate it?
I was gonna say, is that you pre for her first 100K, or is
a little bit? It's actually very interesting. My parents. This is a conversation I won't have very publicly, but there's a lot that my parents and I disagree on about how I run my business, and that's one of them. I think I've heard my mom say a curse word probably once in my entire life. And it was like, damn, or hell, it was like nothing. No, so I mean, that was just me, honestly, just growing up and figuring like, yeah, the F word was not part of my vocabulary for a very long time and thought it was very scandalous and a word that I would never use. And now I say it all the time. No, again, it does piss some people off. But I feel like if you're the kind of person that can't see through that to the kind of content I produce and why it's valuable, then again, you're not really the person I want to talk to. Right. I get criticized, and this is the misogyny of the internet. I get criticized a lot for not being, quote, professional. which I don't know who decided what professionalism is or is not, right? And that's just, I think, the territory of being a woman on the internet, right? Is like, they have a very, very clear idea of what professionalism is. And I'm wondering who defined that for them. But yeah, that for me was a decision that is just, that's just who I am. And it was also, I think it does shock people in a certain way. And I'd be lying, I think, if I didn't think about that as part of my marketing. I'm not out here trying to play it safe. I'm not out here trying to get you all to like me, right? I am very clear as to who I am and who I talk to and how I'm going to present that information. And I feel like it's worked for me. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Oh yeah, definitely does. Okay. And sorry, I know my mom's listening to this also. So sorry, Mom, that I just said fuck. when we come back, Tori and I dig into the nitty-gritty of her creative process, and we even get some of her best advice for being featured in major publications. Right after this. This episode is sponsored by Podcast Movement. For the past decade, Podcast Movement has organized the world's largest gathering of podcasters, featuring thousands of attendees, hundreds of breakout sessions, panels, and workshops, plus the largest trade show in podcasting. Podcast Movement helps podcasters of all experience levels create, grow, and profit from their show. It's suitable for beginners, but you'll also have the opportunity to meet some of the biggest names in the industry. I've been to several Podcast Movement events, and not only is the programming incredible, but the culture and vibe are incredible too. It attracts thoughtful, empathetic, and collaborative people, which makes sense when you think about the medium of podcasting. Podcast Movement hosts two events per year. The first just wrapped up, but their flagship conference is happening August 19th through the 22nd in Washington, D.C. Attendees have the freedom to choose their own adventure across several different stages throughout the four-day event, not to mention dozens of amazing networking events, parties, and the expo hall floor. Tracks include podcast creation, video and live streaming, industry professional, plus several stages of curated programming from some of the top companies in podcasting. It's truly a unique event, and if you are a podcaster, I cannot recommend it enough. Right now, tickets are available at super duper early bird pricing. And as a Creator Science listener, you can save $50 on top of that by visiting podcastmovement.com/science. That's podcastmovement.com/science.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, welcome back. One thing Tori mentioned earlier about her college education was that she had a dual degree, including theater. I don't know how much that served her in her brief stint in corporate America, but I figured it was probably very useful as a content creator.
100% true. No, a lot of people are shocked to hear that. And then as soon as they consume my content for like 5 minutes, they're like, okay, that tracks. A lot of us actually, especially women in the personal finance space, have backgrounds in theater. Erin from Broke Millennial, who's a friend. These are all friends. Stephanie O'Connell. I think there's another one too. There's another prominent woman that, yeah, we like all have theater backgrounds. It's very wild. Oh, Farnoosh Torabi does stand up. Like, it's very interesting. So yeah, on paper, right? You're like, how does this work? This doesn't seem relatable or, you know, in relation to what I'm doing now. But I mean, I'm comfortable in front of people. I can improv when I need to, right? I can think on my feet. I can present very well. I can storytell really well. And that's why I went into marketing. This is the crisis I went through when I was younger is I had a really candid conversation with my parents where I was like, I want to do theater. And they're like, that's not practical. And I was like, you're right. It's not. And I chose the more practical route because financially, I didn't want to struggle. I didn't want to worry where I was going to live or like when I was going to get paid next. So what I did was I found a primary degree that gave me a lot of the things I loved about theater, you know, the storytelling aspect, connection with other people that was more quote unquote practical. Right. So yeah, majored in communication and my second degree, my almost like hobby degree was theater. And so, yeah, I think that has been a huge influence in, of course, how I run my business and how I show up for my business. Because yeah, it's like storytelling and connection with people. That's the big thing at Her First 100K is how do we tell a really good brand story? And also how do we create a community of people who are like-minded and trying to do similar things. So yeah, I think 100% theater is why I'm here, or one of the reasons that makes us different.
I want to pick back up on the story a little bit here. You were plateaued around 4,000 followers on Instagram. Yep. You rebranded. Now you have 470,000 followers on Instagram and millions on TikTok. So how did those platforms grow so much?
Yeah. So I rebranded in early 2019. Things started picking up. I think I hit 10,000 followers on Instagram, which was at the time a big thing because you got swipe up in October. I think it was October of 2019, and then quit my job in November of 2019 to run my business full time. TikTok changed everything. Everything.
And that was after 10,000 followers on Instagram.
Yep. So there was a lot of things that we did, right? And it's very easy to look at my business and be like, okay, cool, TikTok overnight success. And it's like, I worked for 3-4 years to figure out what I wanted to talk about, to gain the trust of people, to gain credibility, to be featured in all these publications in order for me to do well on TikTok. But yeah, TikTok has changed everything. So we have 1.8 million followers on TikTok. And I think 1.5 of those were in a year, which is crazy.
And if you were starting to produce TikToks in, is that the word? Is it TikToks when it's multiple?
Yeah, okay.
You were starting to produce TikToks in July-ish of 2020, but like early to mid 2020. Did you feel like you might be late to that platform at the time?
Yes. I honestly also thought Gen Z is not going to care. I was born in 94. I'm technically still a millennial. I think Gen Z starts at 96, but I'm like right in between almost. I can kind of straddle the line. I do identify more with millennials though than Gen Z. But no, I thought, okay, Gen Z is for dance videos, or Gen Z, excuse me, TikTok. TikTok is for dance videos and like no one's going to care. And I, like many people, got on TikTok during quarantine where I was like, I'm bored. This seems fun. And then was just a consumer of content for like almost 6 months. Yeah, to be honest with you, I was like, I'm going to start producing financial content. I honestly don't think it's going to work. I don't think anybody's going to care. And then I went viral and I was like, oh, okay. They actually care a lot. And I think that this is the narrative that gets brought up with every generation. And I hated it about millennials. And then I found myself thinking it with Gen Z of like, okay, they're not going to care. Like they don't give a shit about anything like adulting. And then it happened and I was like, oh, okay. And then of course, also realizing that like, yes, my audience is skewed younger now that we've blown up on TikTok, but there's plenty of people my age, you know, in that again, like 25 to 34 or even, you know, up to 40 demographic that are on TikTok. So I think that was also the misconception is that, oh, it's a bunch of like 16-year-olds. Yeah. And it's a bunch of 32-year-olds. So yeah, I definitely thought getting on TikTok, I was like, they're not going to care. I'll talk about personal finance and they won't give a shit. But they did. Very, very, very much so.
Was the content you were putting on TikTok in the beginning the same thing you were doing on Instagram? And if so, what was that? And if not, what was different?
No, we got to the point where we realized, you know, after Instagram started promoting Reels, that, you know, it was advantageous of us to, you know, work smarter, not harder, and just take our TikToks, rip them and put them up on Reels. And that's done really well for us in terms of increasing our Instagram audience. In terms of the types of content, I mean, my big business ethos is serve before you sell. And I think it's really important for us to provide value before we ever try to get somebody's money, somebody's follow, somebody's email. You have to prove to somebody why their time, energy that they're going to devote to you is valuable, right? And you prove that by providing value. You prove that by serving before you sell. That doesn't mean you do uncompensated work. Doesn't mean you do uncompensated labor. It just means that you're leading with a service-focused mindset, right? And I think that that's part of the reason why we did well on TikTok. And we had perfected that over on Instagram. We had perfected that type of content. But we were not doing videos on Instagram. TikTok was a whole nother beast. And I had to learn how to edit on TikTok. I still actually, it's kind of archaic, but I still edit my videos actually in TikTok itself. So I think that, yeah, the themes of the content were very similar. It was a different format, which was, yeah, video or trend heavy. And that's the other part about TikTok that we could spend like 2 hours talking about is it's a whole nother beast compared to any other platform. to see any traction on TikTok, you need to be posting at least 3 TikToks a day. That consistency, that schedule is wild. It's unsustainable. It's absolutely crazy. And it's something that, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on. But that was a very different time commitment. Yeah, just very different format of content than we had created before.
You're saying we and us when you're talking about Instagram in like 2020 pre TikTok growth. Was there more than one of you on the team?
Yeah, I made a really intentional decision even when I was running her first 100K as a side hustle when we started 2019 to hire somebody. I could only afford to hire somebody for 5 hours a week, but they were there to help me write blogs and to help answer emails and to help engage in Instagram. And that's a huge tip for entrepreneurs is if you can afford somebody, again, even if it's just for a couple hours a week, that is a very, very, very smart decision. You don't earn brownie points by doing it all yourself. I think you're a smart business owner when you outsource. You're not a smart business owner if you burn out. And if you decide, I have to do it myself because my ego is a business owner. I've gone through that. I just hired a COO a couple of weeks ago and I had like a full reckoning with myself of like, okay, why do you feel like you would be less of a business owner to stop doing operations and hand that to somebody else? Okay, it's because you watch creative people not be able to run a business and you're really excited and proud of yourself that you can also be creative and make money. That's great, Tor, but you need to hire somebody. Like your ego is not helping the business. And actually it's making it worse. So yeah, I mean, even again, when it was just a couple hours a week and that's all I could afford, that was super helpful when I was trying to work a 9-to-5 and also running the business. And I also just say we, because as cheesy as it sounds, like her first 100K has been bigger than me the entire time. Like it's been much larger than just me as an individual. It feels very much like a we, and it pretty much always has.
You mentioned 3 TikToks a day is the pace that you're talking about.
Wild.
I'll actually resist the urge to dig into that. But what I really want to know is you sit down, you're saying, okay, we got to create new content for TikTok and maybe Instagram. What's the framework of how you figure out like what you're going to share? And do you batch it at all?
Definitely batch it. That's for my social media marketer days is you batch every single piece of content you can. It's going to be funny, but literally I batch content when I've done makeup. So today is a batch day because I came on this podcast and did makeup for it. And so now I'm going to film content because I don't love putting makeup on. I don't love putting a whole face of makeup on. And so typically it's like, okay, if I'm doing an interview or I'm doing some sort of press, all right, this is my batch day because I look pretty. So yeah, I think that is just literally what it's come to, especially in quarantine.
So do you have like outlines ready to start recording that you've already like prepped? Here's what I'm going to do.
A lot of it is literally just what questions are people asking? So what are they commenting? What are they, either some people are like making videos that then ask us questions. So like, again, if we're serving before we sell, we already know the types of content people want to see because they're asking us. So that's huge. I typically have some sort of video ideas. I also will just typically get on and just, I know because I'm so tapped into the audience, like what they need or what they're asking for. I also gotten to the point where I can almost predict a video that will go viral before I post it. So I almost know what, like I posted one last week that went viral and I had a really good feeling. I was like, this will probably go viral. So I can't produce those videos every time. I know that there's a lot of filler content that ends up coming out on TikTok just to like placate the algorithm. But I also know I'm pretty tapped in and I know which videos will do well. And they're typically very value-driven, like scripts or things that somebody can walk away with where they know exactly that value piece. So yeah, the video that went viral last week was me talking about how to answer the what are your salary expectations question in a job interview and gave literally like a scripted answer. And that I think at the time of this recording has 1.2 million views. And most of those came in the first like 24 hours. So yeah, I'm pretty tapped into the point where I can almost guarantee if I produce this kind of video with this kind of messaging, it will go viral.
What role does press play in your story? Because some people tell me like press is huge. Some people say like press was a total bust for me. And you've gotten a lot of press. So talk to me about that.
I think a lot of Well, this is my question back to you. A lot of the people who say Press was a bust, are they selling a physical product?
No. Actually, okay. People who sell physical products seem to get more out of Press.
Really?
People who are like just trying to drive traffic and are like, yeah, I went on this TV show and nothing.
That's really interesting because I found if you're going on Press to try to sell, it's not going to work. Like if you're there to sell, I don't know, a candle, I found that that's not really going to work very well. Or at least you have to have a pretty big press hit for it to work. I think press for me has been big in terms of just credibility, right? And just in terms of showcasing that my advice and our community is credible. Yeah, I think that that's been the most important piece of press for us. It's also typically like a 6-month lifespan. Like, let's say somebody found me from Good Morning America and they follow me. They're probably going to be consuming my content for at least 3 months, probably 6, before they buy anything from us or before they actually like take one of our recommendations. And I think, especially with financial media, the people, especially women, are just so worried of making a mistake or so worried that they're going to fuck it up somehow that they need to research and they need to really like trust the person that's giving them that advice. So we kind of expect that. Typically we do get like an influx of traffic or an influx of followers, but in terms of like actual ROI, that might take a while and we're okay with that. We're building trust, we're building credibility, we're serving, we're proving to you, the consumer, why your hard-earned money is safe with us or your email is safe with us or your follow is going to be okay, you know, or good for you. So I think that that's something that we're planning for constantly. The other thing about press is we take it and we milk it for all it's worth. If we're on Good Morning America, I'm putting the GMA logo I'm tattooing it on my forehead. Like it's tattooed on my forehead, right? It is in my podcast press kit. It's on our website. It's on our Instagram bio. It's everywhere we can possibly put it, right? Because that is a huge signal of credibility. And so for me, press, the primary goal of press is not traffic. It's not sales. It's not conversions. It is getting in front of more eyes at the top of the funnel and also another like notch in the lipstick case of credibility.
I heard you on the FI show talking about pre-GMA, you had like 8,000 followers. And then at the time of that interview, which is like in 2020 at some point, you had something like 2 million. Well, was that more like correlation than causation? Are you saying that press is more credibility and the content you made on TikTok and Instagram has been really the driver of growth?
Yeah, they all interweave. When I say it's 100% TikTok, it is. It's 100% TikTok driving that traffic. Literally, I mean, this will blow your mind and you'll appreciate this. We had a video go viral earlier this year that now is our most viral video. It has 6 million views. At the time, I think it had a couple million in a week. We got 100,000 email subscribers just from that video.
Crazy. And you're putting a CTA Crazy. In that video, like go to the link in my bio?
Yep. Go to the link in my bio for our free quiz. Remember I was talking about Jenna Kutcher's quiz? It's almost like I made a note 4 years ago. So yeah, like that was in crazy. But again, this looks like overnight success, right? But the GMA interview I did 2 years previously is a way for me to showcase that I am worth your follow. I'm worth your email, right? So plenty of my TikTok content is literally me green screen in front of a press hit being like, hey, I was featured in Entrepreneur today. This is so cool, right? Because then even if it's a little tiny, but I've planted the seed in their brain of like, oh, this person was highlighted in this place that I trust. Cool. I'll give them my email eventually. It might not be today, but it might be in 2 weeks or it might be in 2 months, right? So all of these things relate together. And again, I'm doing press, not necessarily for conversions, right? I'm doing press so that I can use that press hit for like years and years and years as a way to showcase that I'm credible and I'm worth your time and energy.
And what makes a compelling pitch to a press outlet that you should come on the show or you should share your message?
I love this question. I actually have a media pitch template guide that I sell on my website for pitching podcasts, pitching media. The key actually is Twitter. Slide into reporters' DMs on Twitter. They get millions of emails all the time and they don't read them, but they read their DMs because way less people are in their DMs and it's also directly to them. So I have gotten I get more press hits of them like reaching out to me now, but especially in the early days. Yeah, I got GMA because I was on The Cut, which is New York Magazine. And I got New York Magazine because I slid in the reporter's DMs. So it was like a domino effect, but like really I got GMA by pitching The Cut. So yeah, same thing. New York Times, got in the New York Times by sliding into a reporter's DMs. Got CNBC multiple times, sliding into reporter's DMs. And always think, again, right back to our advice of like, if you are a reporter, what kind of email or what kind of message do you want to read? It is not one, and you can't see me, but like with the law, like a text that says the length of your body, right? You don't want to read that.
It's not a CVS receipt.
No, no. And also it's so tempting. I did this in the early days. I want to tell you every part of my story. I want to tell you, I was born in 1994 in Tacoma, Washington. And I have parents who are really, you know, committed to educating me about personal finance. And then I started my first business at age 9 and I own 15, right? Like I can tell you that story when you interview me. That's what the interview's for. I'm not trying to give you the interview in the DM. I'm just trying to get the interview. So don't give the interview in the DM. Tell them why they should talk to you and why your story is valuable to them. Because that's what reporters are doing. They're constantly like, oh my God, I have this deadline and I don't know who I'm going to talk to. And I don't know what pieces are going to go, right? I have no idea. And I just need to talk to somebody. You are the answer to their prayers. You've slid into their DMs and given them the story that will hopefully do really well for them. And you're like, I would be honored if you would tell my story. That will most likely work for you. And sometimes it doesn't. And that's okay. It just might mean it works in 6 months with the same person, or it might mean you reach out to a different person. But yeah, slide into reporters' DMs on Twitter. Don't be obnoxious. Be super polite. Be super to the point, and it'll work great for you.
My last question, you know, you said in 2020 when you started on TikTok, you felt like you might be too late then. People listening to this probably feel the same way now. One, do you think that's true? And two, if not, how would you encourage people to get started on TikTok?
Perfect example that you're not too late. I'm trying to remember her last name, but she's blown up on TikTok. Her name's Erica. She's like a lawyer who's creating financial content. I think she maybe has 20 videos and she has 3.4 million followers. Like I have done, in terms of legwork, so much more legwork, and she's double my amount of followers without even like blinking because her content's really useful. And it's really, you can, again, go on her account and see what she does. She creates super useful content with exact scripts. And then she always tells you how to follow her. Always. She goes, I learned this from Erica. That's why I follow her. It's brilliant. And she got started on TikTok, I don't know, like 2 months ago. And so I do feel like TikTok's going the way that we knew it would, which is there's a lot of ads. The algorithm changes all the time. So I don't think it's too late. I will encourage you, though, to not do TikTok. One, if your audience isn't there. And two, if you can't keep up with the cadence. Just it's a commitment that you really have to think through. Yes, for me, it was utterly life-changing. That's why I've continued it, because it's changed my business. But I've made a deal with the TikTok devil at this point of like 3 to 5 times posting a day. And that's a lot. And we're having to now restructure the business to figure out like, how do I hire somebody to support me? Because I'm the only one creating content right now. And that's a lot. In addition to running the business, in addition to doing everything else. So don't get on TikTok. Don't get on any platform unless you have the bandwidth and your audience is there. It's another reminder as well that you are building on borrowed land. TikTok could hypothetically ban me for life. They could delete my account. The TikTok could just, as we saw, you know, was it earlier this year? Or maybe it was, I think it was with Trump still, where, you know, he was like wanting to shut down TikTok, right? So TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, any of these can disappear at any time. Emails and SMS are not going to disappear. So if you're going to start another platform, you are building on borrowed land and you need to consider that. That's okay, but you need to have a backup strategy. You need to be getting people's emails somehow. You need to be getting people's SMS or their numbers. You need to be contacting them in a way where you are not dependent on the algorithm, subject to the algorithm, or dependent on, yeah, the ebb and flow of one of these social platforms. So yeah, it's not too late. Just make sure that it does make sense for you and your business and what you're trying to do.
It's been crazy watching Tori's growth over the last couple of years. She first came on my radar from my fiance Mallory watching her content on Instagram, and I feel like I've had a front row seat to what seems like insane exponential growth. But what is really heartening about her story is that this growth really happened from July 2020 and onward, 4 years after she started her blog initially in 2016. I know it's tempting to compare your journey and your timeline to that of others, but if you're a creator today, regardless of when you started, you may just be in your slow growth phase. Slow growth isn't no growth, but slow growth almost always comes before the exponential growth that Tori has experienced. If you're there, don't worry, I'm right there with you. Be patient, keep going, get a little bit better every day, and keep your eyes open for opportunities to try something new. TikTok changed everything for Tori. What will your break look like? If you want to learn more about Tori, you can visit her website at herfirst100k.com or follow her on TikTok or Instagram at herfirst100k. Links to all of that are in the show notes. Thanks to Tori for being on the show. Thank you to Emily Klaus for making the artwork for this episode. Thanks to Nathan Tonhunter for mixing this show and Brian Skeel for creating our music. If you like this episode, you can tweet at jklaus and let me know. And if you really want to say thank you, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
The Podglomerate, a Sonic Universe.